Tell me a little bit about where and when you were born and a little bit of information about your family.
I was born in Paris, France. And we came to the United States in 1948. I came with my father and mother. I have a sister who is 5 years older and stayed in France much longer because she was married and, you know, having a family.
When were you born?
1931.
From 1931 until the war, what was your growing up experience like? You lived in a big city in Paris.
I lived in Paris, and the experience was really, you know, growing up in a normal way, but when you were born in France from parents, you know, born in Russia, you are not really French, and you always felt it. It's a really a Catholic country, and you're not French. And this was confirmed, you know, in later years.
Your parents were born in Russia.
Yes.
When did they come to France?
Let's see, my mother was about 17, and my father was 21. They came from Belts, you know, well-known Belts in Russia. And
did they come together or did they meet in Paris?
No, they came together, they got married, and in fact they were supposed to go to South America, and they got stranded in Amsterdam, and a Jewish organization took compassion and sort of sent them off to Paris, and that's where they landed. You know, it was purely accidental that I was born in France.
So they were alone then without other members of their family in Paris?
Right, but the Jews in Paris were very social. It was a time when my parents came in the 20s. Let's see, my sister was born in 1925. So I think they came around that, you know, 1924.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? But to come back to having no family, the support system, from what I remember, was completely social. This was a time when the Jews turned to a kind of socialism. They thought that socialism would welcome Jews, and they would group into cultural and political groups. And I remember that my parents were part of that. And the Jewish community in Paris was really very supportive, you know, people individually. Actually, it was very segregated because the French did not really accept Jews that much. So that the friends were Jewish mostly, and the life was Jewish.
In what way? In what way was the life Jewish?
Well, let's see. I remember being taken to the Jewish theater to see Maurice Schwartz, you know, and being, as a child, you know, being taken to their organizatia, you know, to watch plays and listen to poets and listen to speeches. And I even remember when there was a Spanish Civil War, there was a young woman on stage, you know, to raise money for the Spanish Civil War. Her head was shaven, and she started to sing all these Spanish songs, and everybody was all worked up about it. And it was very Jewish with neighbors. The neighbors, you know, there were sprinklers of Jews, but they were not, the Jews then were not that religious. It was in my neighborhood, in the 20th part of Paris, which was a blue-collar neighborhood, there was one Jewish family that went to synagogue and observed religiously, kosher and all that. Everybody else was more or less not practicing, but the Jewish identity was there thoroughly. There was no question about that.
So the ethnicity was there, if not the religious practice.
Yeah, completely.
Mm-hmm.
And my parents spoke Jewish in the house, and when people met, they spoke Jewish. I was raised with it, I understand it fluently. I spoke mostly French, but now later on I started to speak Jewish all of a sudden, you know. I understood it. And this is really what saved me during the war years, as far as my identity was concerned. I knew exactly who I was. And since I was raised on stories by Shirley Malachem, and I was raised with... am I doing okay?
You're doing terrific. Yeah.
And I was raised, my mother had a voice like honey, you know, mm-hmm. sweet like honey. And she, after a long day's work, her way of communicating with me was to tell me stories and to sing a lot of Jewish songs, folk songs.
What was the economic situation of your family?
Well, it was a constant struggle. The younger my father was, the more ambitious he was. And little by little, you know, life is hard. And my parents had a beauty parlor. They both worked together. And before the crash, I heard that my father started a beauty parlor where later on it was a large post office, so he was really ambitious. Later, my husband said that my father could have done anything if he would have had the education. He was extremely bright. My mother, up to this day, writes. She's a writer and she reads her stories. She's 76 years old. And she's a fantastic writer in Yiddish, and she goes from group to group and reads her stories. So that, yes, it was a constant struggle. I saw my parents work very hard and lose everything a few times.
Mm. What was your school life like?
That's very interesting. This is where I felt. I still remember to this day my first lesson in geography that I had to learn. I had to learn by heart, and it was that the horizon line is the line that separates the sky from the earth. And I went around jumping on one foot, telling this line to all my neighbors, to my parents, with much pride. The school was a real source of satisfaction for me. It also saved me during the war. And you knew, once you were in school, you knew that you were Jewish, that you were not French, and that your parents were étrangers, strangers.
How did you know that?
Well, all the children, you know, would talk about their church and their activities and their parents, and your name, Potofsky, was not French, and people would keep asking you, where did your parents come from? It was pointed out to you, and you really felt it. You really felt it because you were in the complete minority. There were always one or two Jewish children at the most in a classroom. And I remember, I have to tell you that I was very proud to be Jewish because we always excelled. We always excelled. I don't know for what reason, but we did.
Although you felt different, and you understood that that difference was because of your Jewishness, did you have anti-Semitic experiences in school?
Well, anti-Semitic experience, we would hear about anti-Semitism, but the blatant anti-Semitism started with, you know, with the occupied years, the German mm-hmm. occupation. That's when it came out, you know, really blatantly.
All right, let's start talking about that. At what point did you begin to understand that something was happening in Germany that was suspicious, detrimental, worrisome? You were very young, but you seem to remember very well.
I was 8 years old when the war started. And the first anti-Semitic experience was in school, when I had to wear the yellow star, which said Juif. And I had a few Jewish friends that the first day we were supposed to go into school with the yellow star, which was required of Jews, did not go to school. They were afraid. And I decided that I would go in that day with my star because I was very proud. I was a proud little child.
Let's backtrack a little to the beginning of the war until we get to the occupation. And what were your experiences as a child and as a Jew in Paris at that time? What happened between the point of the rumblings and the wearing of the yellow star?
Okay. The first experience that something was going wrong was we had a neighbor, Monsieur Sandère. They, you know, this couple had one son, and they had a knitting factory. And they were, comparatively to my parents, quite well off, okay? And then one day he was called at the police station, and he never came back. And then it happened to a few people in our neighborhood. And then we heard the rumors that the Germans were experimenting with gas trucks or gas something in the woods. This was what I remember. And we suddenly understood that this is probably what happened to our neighbor, Monsieur Sandère. That was the first thing we heard. Then, you want to know before, you know, like when it just started, then we had to register, which was a great problem.
Only the Jews had to register?
Only the Jews had to register, which was a great problem. Should you register, should you not register? And you had to register at the police station, which was right around the corner from where we lived. We lived at one end of the block, the police station was at the other end of the block. And since you were law-abiding and you didn't know what the consequences would be, I mean, Frenchmen had to register, you know, for forced labor in Germany, so it was another registration. Who could ever imagine that this was the purpose? You were law-abiding, and you know, unfortunately, people registered. That was the second big thing.
What period of time are we talking about?
The period of time, to me, I can't.
Before,
really...
was this before or after the occupation?
No, that was after the occupation.
Everything
after the occupation. Yes. The Germans are the ones that experimented with gas chamber. It's not the French, although the French helped completely to take the Jews.
At this period of time, what were the relationships with Christian neighbors or Christian children in school? How did they react to the registration and the wearing of the yellow star?
Well, the reaction was just what people are. The ones that didn't like Jews couldn't have cared less and thought, you know, it's just another thing that the Germans are requesting. The ones that had a human conscience had it then. It was just a problem. And it turned out that later the Jews that did not register were safe, if they could find a hiding place or if they could leave the country.
Is there a lesson in that?
There's a complete lesson. And it's very interesting, but I can't come about Günter Grass, the German author, who on the occasion of the commemoration, whatever you want to call it, you know, of Hitler coming into power, was asked to write one of the major newspapers in Germany, and he said that because of the German past, historical past, especially Germans have to learn to rebel and protest on an individual level.
Mm. What was your life like as a child during the period of time of going to school, having registered, wearing the yellow star? What was your life like in that of your family?
Well, as I had mentioned, because there are some things that I remember vividly that were major, and you have to bear with me. I cry today. I knew I would. There is no way that the sorrow, and you see, it's very vivid. And I have to cry because I didn't cry then. I went to school that day with a yellow star. And there was a silence in the schoolyard where I used to run and play. You know, I was very active. I was a happy child. And I walked into the yard, you know, and there was a silence that formed, that started, and a circle that was around me with a space around me. And all the children were looking at me with a star. I was the only one that had the courage to go in there and say, yes, this is what I am. Look, I have a star, so what? I was always stubborn about my rights. So I felt, okay, I have the star, so I have the star. I go in and I'm still the same person. And I was defiant. My defiance, which kept me going during the years, started. And then this silence was interrupted by someone screaming out, sale juif, dirty Jew. And then there was I couldn't analyze anything, but probably from children who understand, probably a lot of embarrassment. And little by little, you know, the show was over, they were stunned to see that children. And they started to play again. Then I went to the director of the school and I had to tell her about the incident. That I was not, you know, in any way what they had called me, that I was just Jewish. And she took me on her lap. And she cried, and she hugged me, and she said, as far as I'm concerned, you are my little Sarah. This was my name, Sarah. And what can I tell you? These are difficult times. But continue to study well like you did. That's the most important thing, and don't pay attention. That was the first incident. And you know, it was very vexing to stand there and be called as a different kind of human being, but to be a human being. And little by little, things happened and got worse. My father's business was closed when they started to take Jews systematically. We thought that the people were going to workplaces. We never imagined that they were going to their death. People don't want to face death anyway. Why would they believe that? Why would they believe such an enormous crime? And whoever says that Jews went like sheep, they have absolutely no understanding of the conditions. The Jews would be picked up during the night when they were dazed by sleep. It was usually, you know, 3-4 o'clock in the morning when the world was asleep, which they were anyway. And they were surrounded by French police and the Gestapo, with dogs and guns. And many times, you know, they didn't want to families didn't want to separate. Sometimes they would start the separations right there and then with the buses. Women together, children together. I saw women handing out their babies through the window. And to say that Jews went like sheep, people just don't understand what a war is. They don't understand the brutality of war. I mean, you're just a normal person going about in a normal life, and you don't understand the beast. You know, that it could be that.
What happened to your family after your father's business was closed down?
Well, what happened when it, I remember when it was first that my parents closed, you know, the Germans closed, and they put a seal wax on the doors, and they would check, if you please, if that seal wax would be broken. When things started to be bad, my father joined the underground. He went in the country. He was working on farms in order to make a little bit of a living. And after a while, he was with the Jewish partisans, French Jewish partisans, because they didn't want the French partisans did not want to go with the, to be with the French Jewish partisans. That's where he was. I was told he was working on a farm. I don't know. Once in a while, when I was home, which was not very often, you know, he would bring some food. My mother was taken in for 3 months when they really started to take Jews by neighbors. Like I said, the ones that had a conscience before had it. You know, that's the way they were. They hid her. They just hid her in the house. My sister was older, and she was in a children's home for a while. I was sent off and on different places. And if you want to know, I'll tell you.
Yes.
I was sent, first I was sent, there was a secret organization, the Jewish Scouts went underground. The French Jewish Scouts, you know, Boy Scouts, mm-hmm. but Jewish. They went underground. And they had a network to save Jewish children and to place them in French farms. And I did child labor when I was 10 years old, or even younger, when it really started to get bad. And I remember that I was sent with five, we were a group of five or six children. We didn't know where we were sent. My parents didn't know where we were sent. It turned out in Normandy. And when the train...
Who was responsible for the sending? The Scouts organization?
Yes, mm-hmm. Jewish Scouts, they went underground. We were sent anyway to work on farms and also to be hidden. We didn't know exactly where, but during that train trip again, the train stopped and the Gestapo was looking for someone, and we thought for sure, we didn't know. Okay, they're looking for us. And as they were looking feverishly in that train, probably for some resistant, French resistant, you know, we thought they were looking for us, that was the end. And that was the first time I blanked out. You know, I fell on my knees, I lost my body weight or whatever, and I sort of fainted, you know. But there were other things that happened before that. The reason that we were all going in a different direction was that we, of course, noticed that they would take Jews systematically, the ones that were originally born in Russia, or the ones that were originally born in Poland. It was systematic. The last Jews that they took were the French Jews. And we were considered French Jews, my sister and I. We were born in France. And because of that, my parents, who were born in Russia, were not taken right away. But my parents noticed, you know, the pattern. And after my aunt, uncle, and cousins were taken away, my father said, you know, you don't stay. You know, it's stupid to stay in your apartment. They'll come knocking on the door and take us. Let's run in different directions. If they catch us, they'll catch us one at a time. But we're going to run. We're not going to sit. And that's why we were all separated off and on. And we were lucky. It saved us. We were just lucky. in the end that we were not caught while we were running, you know.
How did you find each other again?
Well, with me, it's like when I was in Normandy, what happened after a while, it was sort of a remote village. And after a while, you had, you know, ration tickets and all that. And there was a stamp, Juif, on the ration card. And people would start to ask questions. So one time when I was in the fields at work, when I came back, someone said that the gendarme, the police, came to ask questions about you.
And you were how old at this time?
10. So that right away I sent a letter to my mother, who was in Paris. And immediately there was like a phone call, you know, at the grocery store, they, you know, put Sarah back on the train right away. And that's it. So I understand in this particular place that the Gestapo came to pick me up 2 weeks later. I was gone. But that we were told that some of the children that were part of that trip with me were taken. So they would take us wherever they could.
Tell me about the changing of your name.
Well, I was very active. I used to, you know, my parents worked, so I would play in the street a lot, you know. Since then, I heard the term street rat. I wasn't exactly a rat, but I certainly, you know, lived in the streets. I loved, you know, playing. And my parents were working, so they always had to call me and look for me, like for dinner and lunch, you know. And at one point, my parents, I came home, that was at the beginning, you know, German occupation and all that, and the store was still open. It didn't take too long, but to have it closed. And they said, okay, we can't call you Sarah all the time. It's, you know, we're Jewish, so which name do you want, Suzanne or Simone? And I think with a, you know, I remember I didn't think, and maybe they say Suzanne last or whatever a child picks up. I say, all right, Suzanne, you know. And then they would call me Suzanne. I didn't know who they were calling. You know, I didn't fix the situation. That's why my name was changed.
So that when they called you, if there was anyone listening, the name Sarah would not be heard.
Right. Mm-hmm. And on one of those farms, I went to a convent school. That was an experience. That was one of the most painful experiences among all the experiences, because I felt that I could not reveal my identity. And I felt like I was a liar. And apparently I wasn't a very good liar. And in order to continue, you know, being safe, I had to pretend not being Jewish.
So that going to the Catholic school was a subterfuge. The people in the school were not taking in Jewish children.
No.
I see.
So I really had to completely cover up. Mm-hmm. And I was absolutely terrified. At the beginning, I was getting as much information as possible. I didn't know the catechism. And the first time I had to go to confession, and the first time I went to confession is sort of a tragic comedy. I was afraid when I would go into the confessional that I would behave in such a way that it would reveal that I was a phony Catholic. And I was reading the catechism, I was trying to get information as much as possible, and then I had a real problem. I had to tell my sins. And goodness knows, I felt like I hadn't done anything. But my only sin was to hide I was a Jew. I was lying. That's a thing, sin to lie. But yet, it wasn't a sin, you know? So I was looking, I don't know what I was doing, but I was looking for an answer. I was tormented by that. To go into the confessional, number one, not to say that I was a Jew. Number two, to lie that I had sinned because I wasn't a sinner.
And you were about 10, 11 at this time?
Yes. My parents had raised me with a lot of love, and they would never spank me or anything, you know, and I don't think I lied. I didn't sin. I was a child who didn't sin. So, lo and behold, at the end of the catechism, they have a list of sins. And I think I read the list, I remember, with great speed and like trying to find like a hungry soul, you know. And I became more and more interested. Ah, I would find something appropriate. And there was a very involved sin, something I had listened to a conversation against the Catholic religion, and to be silent was to take part, to take active part by being silent. How ironical. I thought, geez, you know, the way things are now, if anyone, you know, that's... something against the Catholic religion, or here I was listening to the Catholic religion, what it was all about. I certainly would be silent, so that's a good sin.
So that's the one you chose?
I picked, I wouldn't lie, you know. Mm-hmm. At least, you know, I would be safe saying something sincere.
Was anyone instructing you among the Jewish scouts at this time how to behave in all of these circumstances?
Nothing. Nothing. We were just sent out.
Where did you live?
Where did we live?
Before you went, did you live in the convent school?
Yes.
You lived there?
Yeah.
How about when you worked on the farms? Where did you live?
Well, I lived on the farm, but, you know, it was like you were not accepted, at least where I was not accepted. And a few times the conditions were like, you know, being a slave.
Were these private farms, and
yes,
you were sort of hired out to work,
yes,
there as a child?
Yes.
Oh,
I did child labor. I mean, I worked hard. I worked in fields from like, you know, early morning till the sun would go down.
So you lived on the farm?
Yes.
Wherever you worked?
Also, I remember on one of the places, on Sunday, you had to go to church, you know, and I had so many duties to do before I would go to church, and you wore these high shoes because it was muddy, you know, on the farms. When you went to church, you were supposed to dress up, you know, and all that. I wasn't given the time to do that. So I couldn't go. It would have been a shameful thing to go with muddy shoes. And here, from coming from a loving home where my parents didn't have much, but always very conscious of cleanliness and, you know, dignity about yourself, I would slap on, one time I slapped on black polish on top of the mud, and I ran through the snow to the church because I was late. And I was in the choral group at church too, you know, because I had a nice singing voice. And it was the day, I'll never forget, where it was the holiday, they were about the Virgin Mary. And as I walked in, the priest was preaching about, you know, the Virgin Mary being as white as the snow. And real quick, I thought, geez, it's not really white, the snow. I just stepped into it and I put black polish on the mud, you know, on the shoes. What's he talking about? Then I would sit in church and I would think, I wonder what Papa would think about that. I wonder what Mama would think about that. I always questioned, you know, some of the values of the Catholic Church. It made a Jew, a real Jew out of me.
Were you on these in these situations alone, or were there other hidden children with you?
No, I was all alone. There was no communication.
So that you had to become incorporated in some way into the life of the family.
Well, this is where, you know, food was never warm to me. It was like, you know, all the warmth and love, it was gone. You were a perfect stranger, and you had to be attuned to what was going on, to who you were dealing with early in life. I learned that you had to listen, that you had to look where you were, who you were talking to. You had to be gracious no matter what the, you know, no matter what the hardships. You were not what you were. You had no right to be a human being. And I learned very early to survive.
That's why you're here.
Yes, but I learned later on in life, once in the state, once being free, you know, life is what it is. It's not always kind to you, even under the best conditions. And I had to learn not to survive the hardships of life anymore. Life is not meant to survive, it's meant to live. And that's what I learned. But then, let me go back. Because the second time that I blanked out was when we were already, you see, back and forth, we would come back to Paris and go somewhere else. And then when the time came where there was no place to run, where everybody was scared, where everybody was poor and hungry, that's what happens during a war. It's not something on television, it's very real. So we made a secret entrance in the beauty parlor, which was boarded up. The secret entrance was under the stairs. The only persons that knew we were there was our concierge. You know, my parents lived in that apartment house for many, many years, and she took in a few pieces of furniture. And my father made like a little house out of advertisements, cardboard advertisement inside, and we had a tiny little candle in there. And that's where we lived. We slept there. We did everything human beings, you know, who function do there. My father got a job in a steel factory through the foreman. There was a very strong network of resistance in the steel factory because it was German, of course. And he used to be a former client. I understand there were a few Jews in that steel factory. And every week, the resistance, you know, worker that worked there would collect money for people like my father, just so we could subsist. My father would leave when it was dark, and he would come back when it was dark. And that's how we lived. And then he befriended an Algerian who every month, Chaouch, who was a lonely man, he was the only visitor we had besides the concierge and Chaouch. He would put his life at stake to change our ration cards with Juif. And somehow, just pure luck, they didn't ask what Chaouch was doing with those ration cards, strangely enough. And when they started to take Romanian Jews, my uncle was of Romanian origin, because we were at one end of the block and the police station was at the other end, whenever they took Jews, we were the first ones to know it. We could hear the cries, we could see the buses. That's when, if I was there or my sister was there, we would run from one hiding place to another to let people know that they were taking Jews. And when they took Romanian Jews, I ran to, we didn't know who they were taking, but I would alert my, you know, my family always first. And they stayed in their apartment. They didn't hide like we did. So I would run there first, and then people would leave their place of living, and they would hide somewhere. Goodness knows where they would hide. And I got there too late. I was told that they had been taken away a few minutes ago, and that's when I blanked out again. I didn't want to live when this would happen. Then I ran back. It would take them a few hours. And I saw my aunt on a bus. She didn't see me. She was crying. My cousin was 19 years old. They separated them right there and then. Later on, my cousin who was, you know, no, they had two sons who was married. It was one of those young romances, you know, my cousin, he was married, he had a wife, not really a common law wife when he was like 18, he fathered a child, you know. Goodness knows she had no idea the trials that she would go through, that young woman. You know, she was not raised as a practicing Catholic, she suffered like a Jew. Now, he was taken also, eventually. During the 3 months, we would hear, they took the Jews to Drancy. They were like big buildings, maybe old factories. It was near Paris. And we heard that my cousin Georges was taken to Drancy. So we would try just any sign of life, you know. And one Sunday, we went to Drancy. It was just so incongruous, you know. All these Jews that were in danger would go on Sunday to see if they could see it from a distance. They had walls and barbed wires, you know, to see a familiar face. You couldn't see, it was too far. And unfortunately, the Sunday that we went to see if we could see Georges, they painted all the windows blue, so we couldn't even see them. And the Gestapo was like, watching, you know, all this. And once in a while we would hear that someone with a stick would write messages in the air, you know, and that the Gestapo got a hold of the person. Anyway, my cousin Georges came home from Drancy. He had the beginning of cholera. He came home after 3 months in Drancy. He was there, I guess, by some kind of fate, you know, he wasn't sent to a camp. And he was completely changed, completely changed. He came home like a skeleton. You couldn't recognize him, and he had the beginning of cholera. They had an epidemic of cholera. And little by little, he volunteered once in a while. He was like a dead man, but alive, information. Yeah, they killed a live dog, you know, to have something to eat.
What happened at the end of the war? How did your family, how were they together? What were they able to resurrect of their lives?
We came back and we lived in the store, like I told you, off and on. There was no place to run. There was nowhere to go. The story, you know, the life of Anne Frank is a classic story. We hid in the store, and then my father worked in that factory. My mother would knit, you know, gloves and things, and the concierge would sell them for her. And I would read. It saved me. You know, it saved me.
Where did you get the books?
We had books. We just had books in the house. The apartment was upstairs. Once in a while, my mother would run upstairs to make something hot. You know? And I can't tell you, but I had, you know, my little story books. And then one morning we heard voices around 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, right smack in front of the store. And it was the police. They were gathering together because the French police, after helping to take the Jews, after helping the Gestapo, became glorified resistant. They joined the underground resistance to liberate, help them liberate Paris from the Germans, you know, after they helped so well to take women, children, you know. I mean, nobody quit their job. They were helpful. Let me tell you, one time I went by the police station at the beginning when I was wearing the star, and one corner was not sewn, you know, it was loose, and the policeman said, "Va dire à ta mère, il faut coudre ça. Go tell your mother to sew it." What was his business? They helped, the French police helped, the French people helped. You know, they helped the Gestapo. They did a thorough, good job to help take the children. They did a good job. So anyway, we heard these voices and that the Americans, you know, had landed in Normandy, and that the end was near. We couldn't believe it. We were hiding together. We were waiting to be discovered. And by then, my parents decided if we had any time left to live, we should be together. And that's it. That's why we were together, because we couldn't run anymore, you know. And it had its after effect. I mean, we went back into the apartment. The first thing I did was to go outside and build barricades with everybody to catch every German and collaborator as possible, to catch every guilty person. We just wanted to block them and catch them. That's all. And I saw the woman that had collaborated with their head shaven, you know. I also saw the resistance. They came, the Gestapo, a collaborator called the Gestapo headquarters, and they came with 2 tanks at the police station. By then, we were watching upstairs in the apartment. They were too busy to take Jews, right? They didn't take Jews anymore. And we remember them yelling out, you know, come out. Supposedly there was a meeting of the police and the resistance. But there was a movie house across the street. That's where they had the meeting, not in the police station. And with the, you know, the, what do you call those?
Megaphone.
Yes. You come out, otherwise we blow up the police station. And then they turned around, they got the information that the meeting was taking place in the movie house across the street. And I remember 5 men came out with their hands up. And they had, some of them had the FFE, you know, tricolor, you know, mm-hmm. resistance. No. It's when they searched them. I remember seeing one of these coming out of the pocket, because they wore them while they were trying to catch every German and blow up things. And they shot them. They shot them. All of them.
Did you know immediately after the war that you wanted to leave France?
Well, after the war, we were like stunned, you know. I think my father looked gaunt and old. We had orange crates, whatever, you know, we didn't have anything. And it was cold. We had no means to heat the apartment. And there was a knock on the door one night, and this towering American soldier came in, and he said, "I'm your cousin." And we knew we had family that was alive in this country, and that's why we came. The first thing he did was to take his army jacket, put that on my sister because she was like blue from cold. And we had loved ones again, and that's why we came. We waited 2 years. There was a quota. My father had two brothers and a sister here, and my mother had two brothers here. And we came here because there was family here. But you know what? It was very strange. I was very happy to have the family, but I, out of loyalty, that's where it's a kind of illness to have survived the Holocaust. Out of love for my family that was taken, that their life was snapped away, you know? Out of love to their memory, I realized years later that I never could give my love to the family here. It was the same thing with friends, the friends that my playmates, Marguerite, Michelle, that were taken away, my little Jewish playmates. I could not make friends. I didn't want friends. Up to these days, I am very reluctant to make friends. It's an illness to have gone through the Holocaust. And I really understand that. You know, it stays with there are flashes that come every day. And I call them my prayers. I call them my prayers because when you were busy surviving and running, you didn't realize what was really happening. And you never mourned. You never really, like any human being, you know, reflected. It's later that you did that. And I think, I swear to you, I think I'm a very wholesome person. You know, I work, I have a profession in the arts that is very consuming, that I really enjoy and that I do very well. But this side of me is another side. I am forever mourning. And you know, I don't know what that word means, forgiving. What is that word? I don't want vengeance. I don't think so. I don't want vengeance. Because if you live today and you have that in your heart, it's too destructive. Vengeance is very destructive. But when someone like Klaus Barbie is caught, I'm glad they catch him. And I think that they should not be free. I don't believe in death sentence. I don't believe in anyone dying. And I couldn't care less by now if Klaus Barbie lives or dies. He did it already. It's not, if it could bring anybody back to life, you know, that would be, you know, okay, go ahead, do anything you want to him. It's not going to do anything. The only thing it brings out that this country, the United States, protected a war criminal, used him, and disregarded his crimes. So that when they catch a war criminal, I am glad. I'm not glad, but I feel like partly justice is continuing. And this has to be done. It has to continue. Just throw them in a hole somewhere the rest of their life, because they took other people's lives. So, you know, you're marked. My children tell me, Mother, you know, we read about being exercised, you know, like taking... Can this be done for you? Can this be done for you? You're so wonderful. You're so full of life. You have such intelligence. You have such intellect. But this is the darker side of you. We don't enjoy this in you. Could this be taken care of? And I tell them it's not possible. First of all, the memory is a responsibility. Life is a responsibility. I have the duty to live fully and not waste my life. That's my life today.